It's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, February 19. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state, we should look for a mild Monday with clouds and sun. Winds south 8 to 15 miles per hour. Tuesday, mostly sunny and mild. Winds southwest 7 to 14 miles per hour. On Wednesday, mostly sunny. Now here's the more detailed forecast for the next few days in central Iowa. Today and tonight, look for a high of 53 and a low of 26. We'll have a mild Monday with times of clouds and sun. Breezy in the afternoon, winds south 8 to 16 miles per hour. Clearing Monday night with winds west 6 to 12 miles per hour. On Tuesday, mostly sunny and mild with a high of 52 and a low of 36. Wednesday, look for a mostly sunny and milder with a high of 61 and a low of 38. Thursday, mostly cloudy and breezy with a high of 55 and a low of 25. Looking now at the precipitation in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Saturday, we've had a trace. And in the month to date, we've had 42 hundredths of an inch against a normal at this time of the month of 75 hundredths of an inch. Our year to date has been 2.33 inches against a normal of 1.83 inches. And last year at this time, we'd had 2.39 inches of precipitation. Our snowfall in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Saturday has been just a trace. Our month to date, 4.2 inches. Our normal month to date, 6.7 inches. The season to date, remembering the season includes the last few months of 2023, and the season to date, we've had 34.2 inches against a normal season to date of 27.2 inches. Sunrise today was at 7:05 a.m., sunset tonight at 5:52 p.m. Moonrise today, 1:02 p.m., moonset tonight, 4:30 a.m. It's probably tomorrow morning. And if we look at the extremes in temperatures, things are kind of evening out in Iowa with a high yesterday in Council Bluffs. That would be probably Saturday in Council Bluffs of 36 and a low of zero in Sheldon. But nationally in the 48 contiguous states, the extremes are still pretty darn extreme. The high was an 85 at Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and the low was minus 23 at Lake Yellowstone, Wyoming. So still winter in some parts of the country. We turn now to the front page of the Des Moines Register. The lead story says, why are middle-sized farms disappearing? An ag census shows a loss of nearly 586,000 acres over 5 years. Other stories on the front page include these. Voting bills propose widespread changes and would ban drop boxes and limit ballot challenges. And the other front page story says, these Iowa shops sold the most guns used in crime. Now, here with our first story is Nicole.
And we'll start with that. Why are middle-sized farms disappearing? Ag Census shows loss of nearly 586,000 acres over 5 years. Before we begin, there's a medium-sized image of a farmer named Natasha Wilson feeding chickens on her family's farm near Westchester. There's a lot of chickens surrounding her as she's trying to feed them. This is from Donnell Eller of the Des Moines Register. Iowa's smallest and largest farms have proliferated over the past 20 years, while the number of those in the middle is shrinking. The latest U.S. Census of Agriculture shows that statistic. Farms of fewer than 180 acres have increased nearly 12% over the past two decades, according to that census, a comprehensive farm survey the U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts every 5 years. Experts say that is because farmers are scaling down in the face of record high land prices and escalating expenses for seed, fertilizer, tractors, and other equipment and products that's needed to raise crops and livestock. This quote is from Sally Worley, Executive Director of Practical Farmers of Iowa. Sally says farmers who aren't getting or inheriting land from their family have to start with a smaller footprint. The capital startup costs of farming are ridiculously expensive. Buying 300 acres, roughly the average size of an Iowa farm, would cost millions of dollars. At the same time, the number of Iowa farms with 2,000 or more acres spiked 77% from 2002 to 2022. That is the last year the census covers. Those who have resources are taking advantage of the economy of scale, expanding to lower the cost to grow corn, soybeans, and other crops that have slim margins of profit. This is from Chad Hart, an Iowa State University economist. He says, "We're seeing fewer farms, but they're bigger." Meanwhile, over 20 years, the number of Iowa farms between the smallest and the largest, from 180 acres to 1,999, has shrunk by nearly 23%, the census shows. Hart says it's the disappearing middle. He added that the farmers in the category often work jobs off the farm, like selling seed or crop insurance, to help boost their income. Hart says they're doing that other job because it lets them do what they love, and that is farming. Overall, Iowa has 86,911 farms, 3,744 fewer in 2022 than 20 years earlier, according to data. That is despite the census finding that Iowa has added about 800 farms in 5 years, from 2017 until 2022. This year's census shows that the state also has lost nearly 1.8 million acres of farmland to development and also other uses over two decades. That's a 5.5% decline. Nearly 586,000 farm acres were lost over 5 years. The same trend is happening across the country. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, speaking in an online presentation following the census's release, says the nation has 142,000 fewer farms in 2022 than 5 years earlier, and it has 20 million fewer farm acres. The former Iowa governor says survey after survey continues to show a decline. Now, since 1981, when then-Agriculture Secretary Robert Berglund issued a warning that the loss of farms would hurt rural communities and jobs, the U.S. has lost 535,000 farms, according to Vilsack. That is a number equal to the combined total of farms in North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Colorado. Vilsack says that's a wake-up call, adding that President Joe Biden's administration is working to turn the tide, pushing to add income sources for U.S. farmers. For example, the administration is boosting independent meat and poultry operations to offset meatpacking consolidation, helping local and regional food networks that sell directly to consumers, and also adding farm revenue through increased use of renewable energy produced primarily from corn and soybeans, he says. Vilsack says the survey prompts critical questions. Are we okay with losing that many farms? Are we okay with losing that much farmland? Or is there a better way? Can we correct some of the challenges that this data presents? In southeast Iowa, one farm family has embarked on a quest to find a better way. About 5 years ago, Natasha Wilson, who had worked as an attorney, wanted to go back to her family's farm near Westchester. But she wasn't interested in running her parents' traditional corn, soybean, and pig operation. She says, "I love the farm and I love food, and I was really interested in sustainable farming practices." She raises chickens, cattle, and pigs more naturally outside of in pasture and prairie. After long discussions with her parents, the family decided that they would slowly remake the farm, called the West Fork Farmland, into a more diverse operation that sold beef, pork, chicken, eggs, and honey locally. Wilson says, "I was lucky I had parents that were on the same page." She added that the shift was natural because her parents had been raising a few heads of pasture-fed livestock for their own consumption, and they had long used conservation practices like cover crops that keep fertilizer and other nutrients from running into rivers and streams, and also provided grazing for cattle and other livestock. The tradition has been gradual as they've built a customer base in Iowa City and elsewhere, according to Wilson. The operation, which now includes her sister Claire, must be sustainable financially as well as ecologically, Wilson says. She says, "Little by little, we are making changes," adding that her parents are mentoring her and her sister as they build the new business. "And it's really great to do it together," she says. Worley, the Practical Farmers director, says that some mid-size operations like them are seeking to intensify the operations they have instead of expanding. For example, farmers, in addition to raising row crops, are growing cover crops that they can sell to other producers, and they're adding specialty corn that can be used to make tortillas. Worley says the middle is really, really important to our communities, adding that these farmers and their families fill churches and schools, create jobs, and also pay for taxes. She says they're trying to be super creative, but they run into the same issues small farmers do once they start to specialize. They have to find the markets to get their products sold. In 2022, about 2,430 Iowa farms were selling directly to consumers with $30.1 million in sales. That is a 51% hike from 2017, according to the USDA. But still, it was a small slice of the $43.9 billion that Iowans collected, mainly in bulk sales of corn, soybean, pork, and other agricultural products in 2022. Iowa's farm sales were second only to California's at $59 billion, according to the data. Worley says the small operations are seeing the improved sales through the farmers' markets, online offerings, food hubs, and CSAs. CSAs are community-supported agriculture subscriptions. But more work is needed to get grocery stores, restaurants, schools, and other institutions to buy locally grown food. She says it's not necessarily as convenient as getting food from a huge supplier, but the quality of food and sustainability for our communities is really important. Wilson says that her family is cautious about growth, making sure that they have enough local demand to support shifts in their own farm operation. She says, I walked in the door kind of wanting to be like, let's shut it all, but it doesn't work like that. They're now tackling projects like remodeling retired hog confinements into cold storage and warehouse space. They're adding fencing and doing other work that will provide foundation for the growing operation. Wilson says, I'm learning to be patient.
Voting bills propose widespread changes. Iowa Republican lawmakers are advancing legislation that would limit challenges to Donald Trump's place on the 2024 election ballot, as well as make other widespread changes to voting laws. Lawmakers have advanced two identical bills containing the election changes, House Study Bill 697 and Senate Study Bill 3161. Both were passed through full committees last week with Republicans in favor and Democrats opposed. Here's what you should know about the legislation. The legislation would also allow federal candidates convicted of felonies to appear on Iowa's ballots. It would ban ballot drop boxes. It would ban ranked choice voting. And it would require absentee ballots to be returned the day before Election Day to be counted. Here's a breakdown. First of all, the challenges to Trump's candidacy would be limited. The Iowa bill would limit the grounds for any challenges to a presidential candidate in the general election. Political parties are required to submit a certificate with the names of their presidential and vice presidential candidates to the Iowa Secretary of State's office 81 days before the general election. Under the bill, challenges to presidential candidates would be limited to whether that certificate meets all the legal requirements. If the bill in Iowa passed, Iowans could still challenge Trump's eligibility in court, but not through the state's law for objecting to candidates appearing on the ballot. Candidates for other federal offices, such as Congress, could only be challenged on the candidate's age, residency, citizenship, and whether their nominating papers met all the legal requirements. Requirements for federal candidates are set by the U.S. Constitution, and states do not have the authority to place additional requirements on federal candidates as they can with candidates for state office. Candidates for Congress and the presidency would no longer have to sign an affidavit attesting that they know they are disqualified from holding office if they have been convicted of a felony. That means they could appear on Iowa's ballot even if they have been convicted of a felony. Trump faces 91 felony charges in 4 criminal cases around the country, and he has faced challenges to his candidacy in other states under Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment that bars officials from holding office if they have, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States. Second, absentee ballots would be mailed to voters sooner, but would have to be returned sooner. The bill would change the deadline for returning mail-in absentee ballots, requiring them to be delivered to the county auditor's office by close of business on the day before Election Day in order to be counted. Currently, absentee ballots are accepted as long as they arrive by the time polls close on Election Day. County auditors would also be allowed to begin mailing absentee ballots to voters 2 days earlier, starting 22 days before Election Day rather than the 20 days under current law. Iowa Republicans have steadily shortened the state's early voting window from 40 days to 29 days down to 20 days since taking full control of state government in 2016. In-person early voting would remain at 20 days under the bill. Counties would also be required to send voters 3 envelopes with every absentee ballot. While some counties do use a 3-envelope system, some use just 2 envelopes when handling absentee ballots. Voters would be required to mark their absentee ballots with a 4-digit voter certification number or driver's license number. Next, ballot drops would be banned in Iowa. County auditors would no longer be able to set up ballot drop boxes for Iowans to return their absentee ballots under the bill. A wide-ranging 2021 election law currently allows county auditors to set up 1 drop box at the auditor's office under video surveillance. Next, ranked choice voting would be banned in Iowa. It is already not allowed. Ranked choice voting would be explicitly banned under the bill, although a spokesperson for the Iowa Secretary of State's office said Iowa law already prohibits the practice. Ranked choice voting involves voters ranking each candidate in order of preference. If the voter's first choice candidate failed to win support, their vote would be transferred to their second choice candidate and so on until one candidate received a majority. And finally, what are Democrats and Republicans saying about the election bill? Republicans say the bill is about protecting what they call election integrity, while Democrats say that it would make it harder for Iowans to vote. You can say it as many times as you want, but this is not an election integrity bill, said Representative Adam Zabner, a Democrat of Iowa City. This bill will suppress the vote, and it's a favor for one man, Donald Trump, putting his needs in front of the needs of every Iowan who wants to exercise their right to vote, he said. The bill's author, Republican Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton, said activists should not be able to decide who appears on the state's ballot. The only people obsessed with Donald Trump are my friends across the aisle, said Kaufman, who worked for Trump's presidential campaign in Iowa as a senior advisor. I don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Independent, Green Party. I don't care what you are. Ballot access remains with the people.
And the last headline on the front page is, these Iowa shops sold the most guns used in crimes. It's quite of a longer story, so if Twyla, you want to split in the middle, I will holler at you in the middle. Okay, this is from Nick Pezenstaller of the Des Moines Register. The federal government has stepped up its scrutiny of stores that sell guns that's used in crimes, with the number singled out more than doubling in the past 4 years. Which stores sell the most crime guns has been kept secret since 2003, under the George W. Bush administration. But a Freedom of Information Act request from USA Today unearthed a glimpse of them, more than 1,300 across the country. They include 14 in Iowa, 5 of them in the Des Moines Metro. The others are 3 in Cedar Rapids Metro, 2 apiece in Sioux City, and also in Davenport, and 1 each in Cedar Falls and Coralville. The greatest share of outlets targeted in 2023 by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives are many of the larger sellers, including Shields, Bass Pro Shops, Sportsman's Warehouse, and Fleet Farm, which together account for 8 of the Iowa stores. But there are also local outlets, such as JT Guns and Supply in Des Moines, American Brothers and Arms in Ames, or in Sioux City, rather, and Cedar Valley Outfitters in Cedar Falls. Gun stores connected to recent high-profile mass shootings appear on the national list, including River City Firearms in Louisville, which sold the AR-15-style rifle that's used to kill 5 people and injure several others last spring, and Bud's Guns in Lexington, Kentucky, which sold the rifle that's used in a 2022 Highland Park, Illinois 4th of July shooting that killed 7 people and injuring 30 others. Bass Pro Shops in Denver, which sold a Glock handgun and a Remington shotgun that involved in the mass shooting at Aurora, Colorado Theater nearly 12 years ago, appeared on the most recent version of this list as well. But none of those stores or their corporate offices responded to requests for comment. But the chief gun store lobby criticized release of this list as part of Biden administration's name and shame campaign that's aimed at gun shops instead of focusing on criminals. The release of store names is inappropriate and counterproductive. This is according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation's Senior Vice President Larry Keehan. Or is it Keehan? I think it's Keehan. He questioned whether the ATF broke the law by doing that. Keehan says that if the shops are named publicly and there are negative articles suggesting that they're the bad guys, they won't want to cooperate with the ATF as they've done in the past. The criteria from being included on this list is relatively simple. At least 25 guns that's traced to a crime over a year that were purchased within the past 3 years. It's known in law enforcement lingo as time to crime. A short period and an indicator of illegal trafficking of guns. At the urging of the gun lobby, the Trump administration increased that threshold from 10 in 2018. Being listed leads to another layer of scrutiny by the ATF. The shops must submit additional quarterly reports on used firearm purchases to help expose the secondary market for guns that's used in crime. But it's also a warning to those shops. Criminals are targeting you for gun trafficking and straw purchasing, where people legally prohibited from buying firearms enlist in a stand-in purchaser. Gun violence prevention groups, which have pushed for years for more accountability for gun shops, says that release of this list should incentivize shops to get off of it. Josh Sheriff, legal counsel for Brady. Who's Brady? I don't know. I don't know where Brady came from, but this person says it's a notice that for whatever reason you're being targeted by traffickers, a responsible business person would say that I don't want to supply the criminal market, and that is why I am in this business. A small fraction of America's gun shops sell the vast majority of guns that's used in crimes. The ATF is responsible for tracing them, taking the make, model, and serial number, and also sifting through the records to find the chain from manufacturer to the first retail sale to help police solve crime. ATF representatives are quick to note that being on their demand to list itself is not an indication of wrongdoing. Shops and pawn dealers in the program represent about 3% of the roughly 80,000 licensees across the country. Let's see. ATF spokeswoman Christina Mastro-Pasqua wrote in an email, a number of factors including geography, sales volume, secondary market transfers by an original lawful purchasers, and the level of sophistication of firearm traffickers may be involved in a trace crime gun. Not much is public about the source of crime guns, largely because of efforts by the gun lobby and a key congressional amendment known as Tiahart, named after former Representative Todd Tiahart, a Republican from Kansas. The 2003 law prohibits the ATF from releasing the trace data to researchers, members of the public, or even city and state officials who are not directly involved in this program. The obscure Demand 2 program offers a window. The 24-year-old program popped into the public's eye last April after Representative Andrew Clyde, a Republican from Georgia, brought it up at a House subcommittee meeting with ATF Director Stephen Dettelbach. Clyde questions whether crime gun traces are actually involved in bona fide crime, since many tracing requests from local law enforcement to the ATF and ultimately gun sellers relate to guns that have been found by police or those stolen or possessed by people who is barred from having firearms. What he failed to mention was that one of the two gun shops that he owns, Clyde's Armory in Athens, Georgia, has been tagged with the added demand to scrutiny after selling more than 25 guns since 2020 that's later traced to crimes, which the New York Times subsequently reported in August. His shop also appears on a 2023 list that's provided to USA Today. Representatives for Clyde's congressional office referred all the questions to his campaign office, which declined to comment about the ATF program and his inclusion on that list.
And we'll continue with a heading that says Bass Pro and Shields are huge volume gun sellers. The list itself is largely a reflection of the nation's largest gun sellers, but advocates say the time-to-crime weighing helps dilute the impact of volume alone. Bass Pro Shops has 49 stores on the list, including its Altoona location. That amounts to nearly a third of its outlets, including Cabela's in the U.S. Other large retailers, Turner's Outdoorsman, 64% of its stores, Shields, which has stores in West Des Moines, Coralville, Sioux City, and Cedar Falls on the list, 59%. Rural King is 26%. Sportsman's Warehouse, which has a store in Ankeny, is on the list at 21%. And Dunham Stores, 10%. None of those companies responded to requests for comment. Mark Tosh, president of a chain of Virginia gun stores, speculated that any retailer that sells more than 2,000 guns annually would appear on the list. It's the law of averages, he said. His town gun shop stores in Richmond and Collinsville, Virginia, are on the ATF list. Tosh blamed a large volume of sales and his decades in business. The two shops, he said, together sell thousands of guns a year. He also expressed no qualms with working with the ATF to track down crime guns. Our belief is when you buy a firearm, you're a law-abiding citizen with good intent, he said. It doesn't always work that way, so we don't mind doing our part to trace firearms. It's priority number one when tracing center calls, he said. Stopping straw purchasers is a challenge, he said, noting that his staff recently flagged a buyer for whom law enforcement had made three consecutive trace requests. I had a conversation with that man, thanked him for his business, but said we had to protect him, our staff, and our shop, and would not sell to him anymore, Tosh said. I personally trained my 24 employees to look for straw sales, and everyone is empowered to terminate a sale, he added. In Davenport, Janelle Westrom, the owner of Davenport Guns, another store on the list, also said she and her staff keep a close eye out for potential straw purchasers and do what she says calls put a delay on those they suspect so that they can check them out first. When they're FaceTiming their buddy about, do you like this gun or do you like that gun, that person is not walking out with a gun, Westrom said. They report such interactions to their ATF contacts, she said, asking, can you do some research and tell us what's going on with this, she said. Also, like Tosh, Westrom said she does not see the ATF as an adversary, despite the additional reporting requirements. Selling more than 1,000 guns a year, she said, my number one job is to make sure they don't get put in the hands of people not responsible to own them, and I take that seriously, she said. If I owned a restaurant, I would deal with the health department, she said. So ATF is my health department. They're a cost of doing business. Because of the number of guns that we sell, we're going to be looked at and watched, and I understand that. We don't try to slide anything under the covers. She says we are upfront and honest. In Des Moines, the owner of another independent store, JT Guns and Supply on Merle Hay Road, was less than receptive to a reporter's questions about its inclusion on the list. That's crap. This is confidential, owner Reisard Hoffman said before cursing the caller and hanging up. So here's a question. Why is Walmart not on the list? Well, the ATF's most recent nationwide gun tracing analysis showed that pistols were by far the most common type of gun tied to crime, about three-quarters, as opposed to rifles, revolvers, or shotguns. That likely explains some of the notable omissions on the Demand To list, like Walmart, which suspended handgun sales in 1993. It also stopped selling some rifles, like the AR-15, in 2019. The most common manufacturer of pistols traced to crimes are Glock, Smith & Wesson, Taurus, and Sturm Ruger, probably, representing more than half of the pistols traced. Overall, the most traced firearm is the Glock 9mm pistol, with nearly 130,000 guns traced to crime between 2017 and 2021. In general, Keene, with the gun industry lobby, said the Demand To program is an effective tool for regulators to trace more used guns. He said the industry is doing its part, pointing to the NSSF's longtime Don't Lie for the Other Guy campaign to prevent straw purchasing, as well as training its members in best practices. But publicizing the Demand To list, he said, is misleading. The fact you're on the program does not mean you're a bad dealer or anything like that. It just means you fit within the parameters, Keene said. No one in the chain of commerce knows specifically why a firearm is being traced. It's just that it was traced, he added.
All right, now turning to the Metro and Iowa section, there's quite a few stories, so we'll start with, will we all scream if we lose Bowders? There's a large image of that ice cream shop that is on Ingersoll Avenue. There is a listing that shows the building is asking for $1.6 million. This building housing a century-old ice cream shop is now up for sale. Addison Ladders is the author of this piece of the Des Moines Register. A famed Des Moines ice cream shop may be exiting the Ingersoll Avenue home it has occupied for more than 100 years. The Scoop, Bowders, is closed for the season, according to the signage on its door at 3802 Ingersoll, though a real estate listing shows the 3,852-square-foot building is for sale with an asking price of $1.6 million, several times its $325,000 assessed value. Real estate agent Mick Grossman declined to comment. A flyer for the building, which also houses a beauty salon, calls it a rare opportunity to own a property on Ingersoll. Polk County Assessor records show it was built in 1915. The building, last renovated in 1999, comes with an attached parking lot. Kimberly Robertson, the owner of Bowders, declined to say whether the shop will be reopening in the spring. Robertson says, I have so many things in the air, and I will address them as I can. Janae Basic, the owner of the neighboring Access Salon Studio and tenant of Robertson's, did not respond to requests for comment. According to City View, the shop has been for sale at least once previously. In November of 2022, it quoted that Robertson as saying that she was looking to get out of the business. She told that Des Moines Magazine, I've been in here 51 years of my life, so I think it's time that I just pursue options. It's a feeler. Generations of Des Moines residents have treasured Bowders for its ice cream, part of the business since at least the 1930s. But it was first and foremost a pharmacy until 2016, the year after owner and pharmacist Mark Graziano, Robertson's brother, went to federal prison following his conviction for diverting thousands of narcotic pain pills and evading $577,000 in taxes. Graziano handed the store over to his sister, its fate uncertain, although she has kept it in business. The store, now less clear outlook, casts uncertainty over another Bowders institution, the much-loved peppermint bars it has sold annually for about two decades at the Iowa State Fair. But there may be hope for those craving the cookie-crusted concoction. Robertson owned a storage building connected to the former Donut King storefront at 1205 East 33rd Street before it burned down last November. Located across the street from the main entrance to the fairgrounds, it had long operated as a warehouse for Bowders. The Des Moines Plan and Zoning Commission approved plans on February 15th for a new structure at that same address with a familiar-sounding use. Graziano, who represents the business, told the commission, "We can only keep about 250 pounds of ice cream at the fair. We go across the street 2 to 3 times a day. With traffic, there's no way to get the ice cream to the fair from the store." The Ingersoll Avenue store came into the Graziano family in 1947 when Robertson and Graziano's father, Charles Graziano, partnered with then-owner Caroline Bowder. But Bowder's name already had been a part of the city since 1916, when Bowder, believed to have been Des Moines' only female pharmacist, opened a store at 17th and Crocker Streets in Sherman Hill as what's called the handy counter for women. She bought the Norman Drugstore on Ingersoll in 1923 and renamed it, moving her business there. Bowder began advertising the pharmacy's ice cream in the register in the late 1930s. When Charles Graziano bought out the Bowder family in 1961, he declined to refine their frozen offerings. Robertson's told the register in 2017, "We would be in the back room figuring out what flavors we wanted, and he would say, oh honey, that is just lush. That is the best." After taking over from her brother and closing the pharmacy, she turned to the institution's sweeter side, renaming Bowder's Pharmacy as Bowder's Ice Cream. Robertson, herself a pharmacist, says, "We are a family of pharmacists, so if I said ice cream was my best compounding, you should know how seriously I take this."
Well, I just hope we are able to see at least one more season of fresh peach ice cream. Next story. Search begins for a new Perry principal. A rival pair of Iowa search firms is partnering at no cost to help find a successor to Perry High School principal Dan Marburger, who died of wounds suffered in the January 4 shootings at the school. The firms, Grunmeier Leader Services and Ray & Associates, also received approval from the Perry School Board in a special meeting Tuesday to aid in the search for a new principal at the district's elementary school. Dylan Butler, a 17-year-old Perry High School student, killed 11-year-old Amir Jolief and wounded seven other people, including Marburger, before taking his own life. Marburger, who police say tried to intervene to protect students, died 10 days later. He served in the Perry District for nearly 30 years, first as associate principal in 1995, then as principal beginning in 1997. "It's going to be hard to fill his shoes. We really can't. They're just different shoes coming in," said Linda Arndorf, board president. "It's going to be difficult, no matter who it is, to come in, being he was here for so long," she added. The board, in its regular meeting Monday, approved assistant high school principal Brad Snowgren to serve as the interim principal. Perry Elementary principal Ryan Marzen had previously submitted his resignation and will be taking a new role as principal at Schuler Elementary in Waukee, where he resides with his family. The two firms are conducting the principal searches free of charge. Trent Grunmeier of Grunmeier Leader Services said he started thinking about how he could help Perry after hearing the news about the shootings. He then decided to partner with Ray & Associates to offer search services. "What I can offer you and what Ray & Associates can offer you is we can help you when the time is right in hiring principals," Grunmeier said during Tuesday's special board meeting, adding, "We want to try and help Perry continue to be strong and persevere. This is our contribution to helping you pull through the biggest tragedy a school in our state has faced." Molly Schwarzkopf of Ray & Associates said that in every other arena, the two firms are competitors. "We both felt passionately about coming together as two Iowa firms to help an Iowa district," Schwarzkopf said. "This is too important, and we wanted to come together to find you the best fit between the two firms," she added. Grunmeier said he cannot be certain what the pool of applicants will look like, though the two firms will seek a large and diverse groups. "I don't know if people are going to say, I feel committed and want to take it on, or I'm scared and I wouldn't want to walk into that situation because I know it's a lot," Grunmeier said. "What I do know is that between Ray and us, I think we are in the best spot to go after the best pool we can for you," he said. Another benefit the two firms can provide, he added, is to structure a clear and objective hiring process. "With internal candidates and the situation at hand, there's going to be a lot of emotions about who gets fired. What I think we can offer is a little objectivity to try and ensure a fit long term, for not just the right time here and now. What you need is important, but what's going to move forward in the next few years," he said. A news release from Grunmeier Leader Services and Ray Associates said the elementary and high school principal positions will be posted in the near future, with hiring anticipated by mid to late March. Community members will be invited to provide feedback on qualifications for the positions and to serve on interview teams.
The next story from the Metro and Iowa section: lawsuit alleges C60 violations. Workers suffered severe burns in a 2022 explosion. This is from Beyond the Des Moines Register. A worker who was severely burned in a December 2022 explosion inside C60's roofing shingle recycling factory in Marengo has now filed a lawsuit accusing the company and its owners of operating an unsafe workplace and misrepresenting and withholding information about the manufacturing process there. The suit filed in Iowa County is the second by an employee who was injured in that blast, which forced the evacuation of surrounding neighborhoods and set off a massive fire that dozens of firefighters fought for about 17 hours. It says plaintiff Cody Blasberg suffered the brunt of the explosion and had to be intubated and put on a ventilator. The father of three has suffered disfigurement and loss of full mind and body, according to the lawsuit. It adds that his wife, Taylor, also a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and children have now lost his services, support, and companionship, and also society. In addition to C60, the suit names as defendants a long list of associated companies and individuals, including C60 founder Howard Brand, A C60 spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment. C60 was using a proprietary chemical solvent called Kanisku to melt the shingles into their components, oil, sand, and fiberglass. The suit contends the solvent released toxic vapors, which was combustible, and that defendants denied the Iowa Department of Natural Resources staff members entry into that plant and information about the chemical makeup of the proprietary mixture. It also says the defendants failed to properly warn or instruct Blasberg and other employees, quote, of the dangers that's posed by the process and conditions in that facility, and that they also failed to enact safety procedures, such as requiring machinery to be shut off before it was serviced. The lawsuit says defendants knew or should have known that C60 system for recycling asphalt shingles was dangerous. By design, the system employed toxic chemicals and oils that emitted vapors that could explode with a spark. It says that Blasberg was injured on December 8, 2022, when a conveyor belt between two Tremels? Rotating bins that process shingles and solvent became stuck. Asked to repair that belt, Blasberg, as instructed, opened a hatch in one of the still-operating Tremels, which ignited while he was standing in the opening, causing an explosion and then a subsequent fire, according to the lawsuit. The suit also alleges numerous other failures by the defendants, including failing to have an operational automated sprinkler system for fires, violating industry, local, state, and national safety standards for handling or using toxic or flammable chemicals and oils, failing to develop, implement, and maintain at the workplace a written hazard communication program, and withholding information about the nature of C60's manufacturing process. The suit seeks both actual and punitive damages. In April, former C60 worker Kelly Regnold, 58 years old of Dysart, who suffered burns over a third of his body in the blast, filed a similar lawsuit. Both Blasberg and Regnold were working at that plant at the same time of the explosion as employees of Deep Lake Outsourcing LLC. It's a firm identified in court documents as a wholly owned and operated subsidiary company whose work was controlled by and for the benefit of defendants at the C60 site. In both of these cases, Deep Lake Outsourcing and its workers' compensation and insurance carrier, Technology Insurance Company, Inc., have filed liens against any future satisfaction, judgment, compromise, settlement, or other resolutions in order to recover workers' compensation claims that they say have already been paid out. The lien filing for Blasberg was filed on February 8th, claiming that $513,571 that dispersed with possible additional benefits to still be paid out. This filing for Regnold was filed on May 15th this year, or last year rather, claiming to have been paid $681,369 to that point, with possible additional future payments to be paid.
Arrest follows threat against high school in Jewell. One person was taken into custody by police after school officials learned about a threat against a high school in Jewell, the latest in a spate of such cases since fatal shootings January 4 at Perry High School. School officials sent a letter to parents of students at South Hamilton High School alerting them to the threat and the arrest. Officials learned Thursday morning of a conversation that contained a threat against the high school, Superintendent Heather Holmes said in the statement. They contacted authorities and the person who allegedly made the threat was placed in custody, Holmes said. She clarified in a follow-up statement that the suspect who was taken into custody did not have a weapon on campus. Jewell Police Chief David Turpin declined to comment on the case. On February 4, a bomb threat interrupted an Iowa High School Speech Association competition in Ankeny. Police later determined it was a non-credible threat based on interviews with the people involved. On February 9, a Pleasant Hill student faced terrorist threat charges for allegedly making threats toward a classmate. Both came a month after the Perry school shootings. Dylan Butler, a 17-year-old student there, shot and killed 11-year-old Amir Jalif, a student at the adjacent middle school, fatally wounding Perry High School principal Dan Marburger and injuring two other staff members and four students before taking his own life.
In the final story in the Metro and Iowa section, why are gas prices going up in Iowa? This is from Jessica Risch of the Iowa City Press-Citizen. Gas prices are the numbers we love to hate, hate when they rise, and love when they fall. But what causes the prices to fluctuate? Well, generally, gas prices have trended down since the middle of 2022. In 2022, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and global supply pressure pushed that national $5 a gallon. But gas prices have been creeping back up. As of Thursday, the national average for regular gas was $3.28. That is up from $3.15 earlier this week and $3.06 a month ago, according to AAA. But thankfully, Iowa prices are below the national average, with the average price at $2.95. This is according to Gas Bunny. That is up 10 cents in the last week. So why are gas prices going up in Iowa? Well, the gas prices have steadily fallen since the fall of 2023, but gas prices have seen an early 2024 rebound sparked by higher oil costs. Crude oil prices are one of the determining factors as to why gas prices rise. As oil prices rise, so do gas prices. West Texas Intermediate, WTI, is a grade of crude oil that's used as a benchmark in oil pricing. WTI futures are being traded at $76.75 per barrel, and WTI prices are up by 4.51%. Crude oil has to be refined and then processed into gasoline. Then the gas has to be distributed to stations through pipelines and tankers. Distribution, logistics, and transportation costs are bundled into retail fuel prices. The process of turning crude oil into gasoline and distributing it all determines why gas prices ebb and flow. Gas prices also fluctuate because of location and geopolitical conditions. Natural disasters or refinery outages can also cause temporary spikes in gas prices. According to AAA, Iowa's statewide gas prices have remained below the national average. A year ago, Iowa's average was at $3.26 per gallon, while the national average was sitting at $3.41. That is a 15-cent difference. Currently, Iowa's average is 33 cents cheaper than the national average. Iowa kicked off 2024 with gas prices at $2.81 per gallon. Prices reached a low of $2.70 on January 21st before starting to climb once again, according to Gas Buddy data. Currently, a gallon of regular gas on average will cost $2.70 in Des Moines. This is according to data that's collected from Gas Buddy. The lowest gas prices are at the Sam's Club in Windsor Heights, costing $2.62 a gallon, and also the Costco in Ankeny reporting the same price. During winter months, the average gas price tends to fall because of supply and demand. With fewer people traveling, prices tend to be less than in the summer when the demand rises with travel. Here in the Midwest, refineries also switched to a winter blend of gasoline that allows to ignite more easily to start vehicles in colder weather. That blend is usually cheaper to produce and leading to lower prices. In Ames, the average gas price is $3.14 according to Gas Buddy. The lowest price in Ames is $2.78 at the Sam's Club there. Iowa City currently has a higher average cost of regular gas than Des Moines and Ames. According to Gas Buddy, the average price over in Iowa City is $3.39 a gallon. The cheapest place you can go to get gas in the greater Iowa City area is at Costco in Coralville and Come and Go on 1st Avenue. On the note of gas prices, it is so funny because I definitely am one of those people that drive up to Ankeny to get cheaper gas. And the bigger question should be, why is it cheaper in Ankeny than parts of the Des Moines Metro, Twyla?
It's one of the mysteries of the cosmos. Well, that concludes the stories in the Metro and Iowa section. We'll return now to the front page section and pick up some stories that are included in that section, but which come from USA Today. The first, more states pass restrictions on sex ed. When Florida passed a 2022 bill prohibiting classroom discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity for children in kindergarten through third grade, it kicked off a trend. Last year, 8 states enacted laws restricting sex education, often targeting LGBTQ plus discussions in early elementary grades, and in some cases, banning any forms of sex education at those levels. Florida, meanwhile, went on to expand its so-called Don't Say Gay law, making it illegal to teach kids about sexual orientation and gender identity until they're in 9th grade and restricting students' use of their preferred pronouns if they are different than their sex assigned at birth. In addition to the new laws targeting LGBTQ+ content, a few restricted information about abortion. Many were advanced by policymakers who argued that such restrictions were key to protecting parental rights. The new measures across the country represent an 800% jump in restrictive legislation from the prior year, according to the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, an advocacy group that released a new report documenting the legislative trends. Research has shown that sex education that excludes such instruction can leave LGBTQ+ youth poorly equipped to safely navigate their relationships and sexual health, and sets them up for potential mental health challenges as they grow older. So here's a roundup of some of the state laws. In Arkansas, passed two laws limiting sex education, including a far-reaching omnibus measure that prohibits such lessons before fifth grade. The second law requires educators to teach kids about adoption and why it's better than alternatives to continuing a pregnancy and giving birth, such as abortion. In Florida, passed an expanded version of its so-called Don't Say Gay law, implemented last year, banning classroom discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity before third grade. The new law bans such conversations and lessons through eighth grade, while also limiting them from ninth grade through 12th grade if they are not so-called age-appropriate. The law also bans using a student's preferred pronouns if they are different from the child's sex assigned at birth. Moving to Idaho, Idaho already had an abstinence-only policy, but last year it expanded the definition of sexual activities kids ought to abstain from to any intimate physical contact between individuals that could result in pregnancy, cause them to contract sexually transmitted diseases and infections, or present emotional risks. It also limits sex education content to studying the anatomy and physiology of human reproduction, which means, according to the Sexuality and Information and Education Council, it effectively excludes non-heterosexual and non-marital relationships whose end goal is not reproduction. In Indiana, now prohibits sex education in kindergarten through third grade in a law that also, according to the council, includes a clause that pressures school employees to so-called out transgendered students. In Iowa, passed a bill that prohibits teaching children in sixth grade and below about sexual orientation or gender identity. Lawmakers also got rid of a policy requiring instruction about AIDS and human papillomavirus, or HPV. The new law also restricts access to what are called sexually explicit books in libraries. In Kentucky, enacted a law that bans sex education for students in kindergarten through fifth grade and prohibits the Board of Education from approving policies that would require teachers to use students' desired pronouns. Mississippi. Mississippi formerly had a policy requiring abstinence-only education that was set to expire. Last year, it passed a provision deleting the expiration date, which the council said means abstinence-only education is now codified in law. North Dakota, the last state in this roundup, added a sex education requirement mandating that schools show an ultrasound video and an animation depicting a human's development from fertilization to birth. The council says this policy, so-called, seeks to stigmatize abortion and other pregnancy outcomes. That's a quote from the council's report. The National Sex Education Standards, developed by a coalition of groups, including the Sexuality Information and Education Council, offers essential criteria schools can use to ensure that they are providing high-quality, inclusive, and age-appropriate lessons on sex, identity, and relationships. The council says policies such as those enacted last year in eight states run afoul of those standards. The standards say, for example, that elementary students should learn the basics of reproductive anatomy and puberty, and skills like how to set personal boundaries and access resources from trusted adults. Schools should promote inclusivity and include some content on sexual orientation and gender identity in age-appropriate ways. Some conservative groups say such content is inappropriate and discussions about same-sex relationships or gender nonconformity have no place in public school classrooms. The council, however, stressed the importance of teaching this content beginning at a young age. It is in part a matter of safety, said Michelle Slaybaugh, a veteran sex educator who serves as Director of Social Impact and Strategic Communications with the council. Young people need the opportunity to practice the language, to practice being able to articulate their likes and their dislikes when people have crossed boundaries, she said in a presentation on Tuesday. It teaches kids about healthy practices, not only in romantic relationships, but also in platonic friendships. It's important for young people to understand bodily autonomy and consent, she said. Sex education bills and related legislation have increasingly been proposed under the mantle of parental rights. These bills are often far-reaching, comprising provisions that call for book restrictions and bans on students being allowed to use their preferred pronouns on campus. More than 20 such bills were enacted last year across 14 states. The 242 bills introduced last year marked a 73% increase from the previous year. Although there has been a notable uptick in restrictions, the council also documented a movement to protect students' rights to sex education and related learning. 10 states last year passed laws that enshrine protections for the sex ed curriculum. They include laws that require teaching students about dating and sexual violence and healthy relationships. Also, in the aftermath of the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning the constitutional right to an abortion, some states are considering bills that would increase youth access to contraception or other family planning resources.
And before birthdays, we'll get started with our 50 states. We have a few minutes left. I'll start with the highlight state today. It is Oregon. There's a large image of a 46-foot whale being washed ashore on Sunset Beach State Park in Clatsop County in Oregon. So this story is actually out of Salem. It's not yet known what killed an endangered fin whale, but people can marvel at the large marine mammal as it decomposes on an Oregon beach. Tiffany Booth, assistant manager of the Seaside Aquarium, said of the rare sight, "While it is sad, it's also super educational." She says it is only the second dead fin whale that Oregon has seen in about 30 years. "Just don't touch it because it can carry diseases," she said. The 46-foot male whale washed ashore at Sunset Beach State Park last week. It will be several weeks before results from a necropsy will reveal what caused the emaciated whale's death, according to Booth. We're going to move on to Midwest states now, starting with Waukegan, Illinois. A suburban Chicago man who told his estranged wife in a note after he drowned their three young children, "If I can't have them, neither can you." He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. To Fort Wayne, Indiana, a pregnant woman who was found dead in 1992 in a northeastern Indiana basement has been identified through forensic genetic genealogy and DNA that's provided by her father. To Des Moines, Iowa, 6 weeks after a shooting at Perry High School, a bill that would allow Iowa schools to arm staff and require others to hire school resource officers is advancing through the Iowa legislature. To Topeka, Kansas, the Kansas House has recommended the state increase punishments for people who injure or kill police dogs or horses. To Detroit, Michigan, grand opening ceremonies for new Detroit high-rises used to happen once or twice a decade, but lately the mayor has been cutting a ribbon on a new skyscraper at least once a year. That count goes up when including grand openings for once vacant but newly restored high-rises. To Shakopee, Minnesota, Secretary of State Steve Simon joined local election officials last week to conduct a public accuracy test ahead of the presidential primary. The mandatory testing of election equipment happens before every single election and it is open to anyone, not just residents of the area, so that they can observe officials testing the tabulators. And with that, I think it is almost time for birthdays.